This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
New York's extreme school segregation, inequality, inaction, and a damaged future.
We now look at a critical issue. Well, in a report released by UCLA's Civil Rights Project, its co-director said, in the 30 years I have been researching schools in New York State, consistently, it has shown itself to be one of the most segregated states in the nation. No southern state comes close to New York.
And decades of reforms ignoring this issue have not produced strategies that have succeeded in making segregated schools equal. It's time to adopt creative school choice strategies to give more New York children an opportunity to prepare to live and work effectively in a highly multiracial state.
Now to talk about New York's extreme school segregation, inequality, inaction, and a damaged future is Gary Orfield, co-director of the Civil Rights Project, Proyecto Derechos Civiles.
Good to talk to you.
Well, I'm horrified by distinguishing ourselves in New York as the most segregated school system in the nation. For real? More than, I mean, how did that emerge? How is that possible as against the history of school segregation and so on that has existed in the South? Could you give us some sort of context for that?
Sure. It's very hard for people to understand because nobody's talked about it for decades and people just let it happen. What happened, of course, was that before the Brown decision, almost 60 years ago now, there were 17 states in the United States plus the Washington, D.C. that had segregation by law. We had total apartheid in those states, and those are the places where a substantial majority of African Americans have always lived and live now. It was an absolute crisis. All of those places were forced by the courts and by the 1964 Civil Rights Act to do something about segregation. The North really wasn't forced in the same way, ever. George Wallace of Alabama used to mock New York and Washington as limousine liberals who forced change on the South and did nothing about their own homes. And it wasn't entirely wrong. The Supreme Court didn't say anything about the North for two decades after the Brown decision. When it did, it limited desegregation to central cities and kind of created a legal barrier to including the suburbs. Even that decision was never enforced seriously. No one ever had enough money to sue the New York City public schools. So there never was a court order for New York. So New York's never really had a desegregation plan. There were times during the 1970s and 60s where leaders of the New York state government, especially some of the educational leaders, tried to push to have something done, but nothing really ever happened on a serious level, and the effort was basically abandoned. There were some court orders in upstate New York, and Buffalo particularly, and there were some creative things done, especially up there where there were big magnet school efforts. And, of course, there are a few integrated suburbs that were stably integrated outside of New York City. But the vast majority of the state, nothing was really done about it. So we underlying this problem is a very serious housing segregation, very serious for both blacks and Latinos compared to the rest of the country, and a tremendous fragmentation of metropolitan areas into many separate school districts, in contrast to a number of southern states where basically you have countywide school districts. So high segregation, lots of boundaries, no action. And then on top of that, we put in choice plans that exacerbate segregation. We learned back in the 1960s that if you have choice without civil rights protections, it tends to make inequality worse. But basically, the charter school and the voucher efforts that have come along since 1990 have not had civil rights provisions and have tended to make segregation even worse. So we're not doing anything. We have underlying bad segregation. We have no plans. And we are creating new schools that are even more segregated than the ones we've had all along.
Gary, let me just take you back also for a moment and figure out where you look at this on the compendium. One of my most frightening demonstrations, notwithstanding having gone to many activities and protests in the South and so on, was actually in South Boston, for example, during the busing issues, where the crowd had a level of violence and hostility that was just paramount. The issue of busing, did that not make any kind of inroad into the quality and the degree of segregation that we have, certainly in the northern venues?
Most busing, which is what George Wallace called school desegregation, urban school desegregation. Most children in the United States are bused to school, and it's called busing when it involves integration. But most of that really happened in the South. It really never did happen on any substantial scale in New York. And in upstate New York, it happened in some locations, but basically choice was used much more, particularly magnet schools. Mm. Senator Moynihan was a great advocate of magnet schools and was one of the fathers of the Magnet School Assistance Act that helped make it possible to use choice methods to produce desegregation. Unfortunately, that law, that program was scrapped by the Reagan administration in its first budget. But there really never were large busing orders in New York. Though, ironically, the largest ones, the most dramatic ones that included both the cities and the suburbs, which took place in southern communities mostly, produced the most long-lasting desegregation and also produced increases in residential integration. But there haven't really been any new, what we call busing orders since the 1980s, since the early 1980s. We're really talking about how we use our choice methods and whether we're going to use them in a way that increases segregation or increases diversity and stable integration.
What is the impact of this kind of segregation on the children, on the students?
The impact is really serious, in part because it's not just segregation by race or ethnicity. It's almost always double segregation by both race and poverty. So these schools not only create a situation where millions of African American and Latino kids are raised with really no contact with whites, but also with almost no contact with middle-class kids and families and connections. Those schools that have concentrated poverty, and it's extremely concentrated in many New York City schools, for example, tend to have lots of kids with unstable housing, move frequently and voluntarily, which is very disruptive to schooling, tend to have lots of kids with untreated chronic medical problems, tend to have lots of kids who don't get adequate nutrition, tend to have lots of kids who live in settings that are unstable emotionally and violent, tend to have gangs, tend to have lots of things that middle-class communities don't have to deal with. And those schools tend to get the most inexperienced teachers who tend to leave them the quickest. That tends to produce all kinds of problems. The typical classroom might have a number of kids who have emotional problems, a number of kids who weren't there a few months earlier, some kids who don't speak English and really haven't been given good preparation, many kids whose parents aren't well educated, many families, most families who don't have the resources at home to really support them. And the parents in those schools tend to have relatively little organization and political power in the fight for resources in the school districts. So there's many, many dimensions of inequality that reinforce the racial segregation.
Sounds like we've got a kind of peculiar form of Plessy versus Ferguson, which was overruled, separate and inherently unequal by virtue of what you're suggesting is. And I want to ask a more provocative question off of that. You're suggesting certainly that integration brings about a higher level of equality for the collective body of students. The provocative part of this is integration really the panacea? Does that really stand to effectuate change from the kind of disparity of treatment of Black and Latinos habitually in the public school system as compared to white, certainly middle class and upper middle class children?
Well, there really is no one panacea. I mean, that was pretty obvious to the people in the civil rights era. You know, the March on Washington was called the March on Washington for jobs and freedom because people knew that the economic situation of the families was extremely important, as were the rights. If you create integrated schools, you don't create total equality in outcomes, and sometimes you don't create really fair treatment inside those schools. It's a necessary step, but it really isn't sufficient. And, you know, you can discriminate inside of multiracial institutions as you can between white and minority institutions. So we have to think of it as part of a solution. It does create access to places where there are better sets of opportunities and where there are potentials. But if those are going to be realized and made available fairly, the institution has to train the people who run it. They have to be sensitive. They have to be fair to everybody. The leadership has to be committed to that. And it's still hard because kids come to school way, way behind before kindergarten because their families have such different opportunities and resources. So, no, it's not a panacea. If you compare integration to perfect equality, it's a failure. If you compare it to segregation, it's a great success. And nobody should understand it as a total solution, but they should understand it as a really important and basic part of a solution where it is feasible. And it certainly isn't feasible everywhere, but it is feasible lots of places. And to the extent that we can do it, it is a very valuable resource. And it's not just a resource for the minority kids. It's a great resource for the white kids and the Asian kids as well. They're going to be living and working in a society without any racial majority. And if they don't understand the other groups of folks that they're working with and their culture and learn to respect them, things aren't going to work out as well as they should in our institutions.
So now that we've sort of diagnosed the disease, what are some prescriptions for change?
Well, basically it's important to think about what we can do both about housing segregation and about schools, since housing is directly related. If you can solve the housing issue, you can get access to more diverse schools that are more diverse racially and economically and better opportunities. So we need to have really serious fair housing enforcement. We need to have enforcement that we haven't really seen against mortgage discrimination, which produced all these predatory loans that resulted in huge losses of wealth for minority families in the Great Recession. We have to think about plans for areas that are diverse to stay diverse through urban planning, through civil rights enforcement, through all kinds of coordinated efforts to make sure that those communities continue to welcome and treat well people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. In terms of schools, we need to make sure that where we have choices, that those choices are offered fairly, and there's a set of civil rights policies that they need to have. One of them is that those schools will have a plan to be diverse and welcome people from all backgrounds. They'll welcome people who don't speak English. They'll welcome people who are handicapped, and they'll welcome people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds, and they'll reach out and inform people in those different communities about the opportunities. Secondly, they won't use a test or screening mechanism in choosing who comes in. The choice should be on the basis of student and family interest, not on the basis of exclusionary policies that are related to social class and family advantage. A third thing is there should be transportation, because if you don't offer transportation when you have choice, you're only offering the choice to the people who can afford to provide their own transportation. And that just increases inequality. We should have schools that offer really genuine choices that are worth choosing. That's where having a good magnet school program is important, because you can offer things at an individual school you can't or really shouldn't offer to everybody in a school district. But you need to offer them fairly and make people aware and make them welcome, and help them get there. So those are elements of a choice policy that we really need to think about, and it should be required in all choice programs, whether they're regular public schools, small schools, special schools, or charter schools.
And what is the situation, since you brought up the charter schools, how do they fare in terms of the issue of segregation?
They're really shockingly segregated. I mean, if you look at our report, which your listeners can see at civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, or just Google Civil Rights Project, if you look at this report, you see that the charter schools are incredibly segregated. 97% of the charter schools in Manhattan are intensely segregated. In some other boroughs, it's 100%. You just can't get that level of segregation without really having none of these civil rights policies in place. So they're significantly worse than the public schools and much worse than the magnet schools, which aren't as good as they ought to be either. The charter school movement has neglected the lessons that we learned in the South 50 years ago about how the conditions under which choice should be fair. We wrote a whole book about this called Educational Delusions from University of California Press. People might be interested in reading it because it's all about what we learned a long time ago and what we forgot about fair choice programs.
Really, thank you for catching us up with this stark, startling, and painful news. And of course, absolutely, there's never been a question in my mind that the patterns of segregation within the housing strata filter down to, and look, you control where people live, you control everything else in the environment, the resources they have, the schools, and so on. So we've got a lot of work to do, and I encourage people again, where should they go to get a copy of this important report?
civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, and there's lots of discussion in here about housing issues, like what can be done in gentrifying neighborhoods and what can be done in racially changing suburbs, which offer lots of opportunities.
CPR co-director Gary Orfield, thank you for the report, and thank you for joining us.
And now we return to the struggles of the civil rights era of the 1960s with excerpts from Freedom Summer, a new video by Stanley Nelson celebrating the struggle for voters' rights in Mississippi 50 years ago.
Hear that freedom train a-coming. Hear that freedom train a-coming. Well, hear that freedom train a-coming.
Spending a summer in Mississippi taught me a lot about this country. My high school social studies teacher taught me that we all have rights. Mississippi summer taught me that we didn't all have rights.
When we began to go to Mississippi, the black people we met there were not interested in lunch counters. They weren't interested in sitting in the front of the bus. There were no lunch counters. There were no buses. They wanted to vote.
It'll be carrying registered voters. It'll be carrying registered voters.
I just made up my mind that I was going to be a registered voter. I never wanted to be a politician. I just wanted the right to vote.
I don't want the nigger as I have known him and contacted him during my lifetime to control the making of the law that controls me, to control the government under which I live.
I don't think people understand how violent Mississippi was. Terrorism led black people to the obvious conclusion. If they try and vote, they're messing with white folks' business, and they can get hurt or killed.
We hope to send into Mississippi this summer upwards of 1,000 students from all around the country who will engage in what we're calling freedom schools, community center programs, voter registration activity, and in general, a program designed to open up Mississippi to the country.
The burned out station wagon in which the three civil rights workers were last seen has been processed by FBI laboratory investigators.
I knew it was going to be bad. I didn't dream for a minute that people would be killed. But it was always in the back of everybody's mind that something, that things, bad things were going to happen. So it was terrifying. But if you cared about this country and you cared about democracy, then you had to go down.
I'm going down the Mississippi. Oh, I'm going down a southern road. And if you never see me again, remember that I had to go. Remember that I had to go.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a militant group in the South with support from other major civil rights organizations, is readying a massive program called the Mississippi Summer Project, a campaign that may have no parallel since the days of Reconstruction.
I'd heard about Mississippi all of my life growing up. But nonetheless, the fact that the people in Mississippi couldn't vote was just a shock, even to me there in Memphis. I thought that it was very important to go to Mississippi and make a statement about the horrors that confronted black people there.
This Ivy League campus is one of the staging bases for an invasion of Mississippi by college students. The students are being recruited all over the United States from Harvard to Hawaii. They will go to live in Mississippi this summer to fight for the Negroes' civil rights.
I first heard about Freedom Summer in the spring of 1964. I saw a brochure on the bulletin board at Drake University, where I was a student, which is in Iowa. And it just caught my eye immediately.
I had been making drawings for corporations and colleges, and my wife, June, felt very deeply about the injustice in the country, as did I. So he decided that I would take my skills as an illustrator and go to Mississippi. I was 20 years older than they were, but I was part of the group.
My job was recruiting. Students heard about the project, either through me or the campus newspaper. Then they contacted us for an interview and for an application.
I'm a junior at Queens College, majoring in anthropology. My schooling so far has been oriented toward history, and I have a good knowledge of current affairs. Finally, I have a good deal of experience with racial and religious prejudices in the North and South. Andrew Goodman.
I have just returned from a spring project on a voter registration drive in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I was filled with an overwhelming desire to clean the rot out of America. All I can say is that it's very important to me that I play my role in civil rights for the U.S., and most of all, for myself. Linda Wetmore.
We were looking for people who believed that this was important, who would be respectful to the black community, who were not nutcases, who were not divas, and who were not people who were going down to show the world how great they were. This was a majority black organization with black people telling white people what to do.
Now, Phil, let's say you're in Mississippi and Bob Moses, who's the director of the project, comes over to you and says, Phil, will you spend the next 4 weeks typing index cards or some other task that you might not care for very much? What would you react? How would you react to that?
I would certainly say yes, but I would hope that
I do hope that I can participate more actively in the movement, if this is where he wants me to be. Of course, that's what I'll do.
We turned down people. There were many more people who wanted to go. But from the point of view of safety for the whole project, we had to have people who were as together as you can be when you're 19 or 20.
When we were sure that Freedom Summer would actually happen, Jim Foreman, the executive director of SNCC, sent a number of people who would be paid field staff into Mississippi to help pave the way.
Part of the application process to be considered as part of the field staff was to write a letter of application. And this is part of the letter that I wrote. I wish to become an active participant rather than a passive onlooker. As my husband and I are in close agreement as to our philosophy and involvement in the civil rights struggle, I wish to work near him in whatever capacity I may be most useful. My hope is to someday pass on to the children we may have a world containing more respect for the dignity and worth of all men than that world which was willed to us.
For these students, it will be a longer, hotter summer than for almost anyone else in this country. But they believe their project will be the breakthrough in the civil rights battle. Their motto, crack Mississippi and you crack the whole South.
Well, it'll be rolling through Mississippi. It'll be rolling, rolling through Mississippi. Well, it'll be rolling through Mississippi, oh, get on board, get on board.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.